Let's call this meeting of the House Finance Committee to order. Let the record indicate that it is 3:06 p.m. on Wednesday, April 6, 2016. Present, we have Representative Wilson, Representative Guerra, Representative Kawasaki, myself, Co-Chair Thompson. We have Co-Chair Newman. We have Representative Guttenberg, Representative Gaddis, Representative Edgman, Representative Munoz, and we'll have a couple more joining us shortly. Again, a reminder, turn off your cell phones. No electronic devices allowed in committee. On today's schedule, we have HB 247, Tax, Credits, Interest, Refunds, Oil and Gas. We have a CS for this bill, version F. Representative Newman, can you make a motion?
Sure can, Mr. Co-Chair. I'd like to move to bring committee substitute for House Bill 247, Finance Version 29-GH 2609/F before the committee for discussion purposes and committee referral.
All right. Okay. Basically, let me kind of run through the top part of this. Some of the changes that we've done is interest on delinquent taxes will be 5% above the 12th Federal Reserve District rate compounded quarterly for the first 4 years, then straight interest at 5% above the 12th Federal Reserve District for the next 2 years. And the next item will be hardening the floor to 2% of the gross value at the point of production. And other changes we've made, adjustments to the Cook Inlet credits. We worked this from the House Resource version. House Resources net operating losses, they had it at 25-10-10. QCE was 20-20-20. And WLE's expense, 40-30-20. What we did with this version is net operating losses, we left those the same as the resource committees at 25-10-10. The QCE resources had 20-20-20. We changed that to 20, and in January of 17 to 10, and January of 18 to 10. And WLEs, we left the same as resources, 40, 30, and 20. And those are on Cook Inlet credits. Men's Frontier Basin credits to extend for expenditures to complete an exploration well that was spudded but not completed before July 1st, 2016. Also extended Cook Inlet credits to Middle Earth to hold Middle Earth harmless. It reduces the cap on credits that the department may purchase from $200 million to $100 million for a person in a year. And men's new oil and GVR to new oil for 5 years would be the new definition, if you want to call it that. And so it would be 5 years on new oil. And it removes the Cook Inlet tax cap on oil January 1st of 2017. And at this time, I'd like to have my staff, Jane Pearson, and her lifeline, Don Bullock, come to the table, please, to explain the the differences between the two. Place yourselves on the record and explanations.
For the record, my name is Jane Pearson, staff to Representative Steve Thompson.
My name is Donald Bullock. I'm staff of the House Majority.
Chair Thompson, at this time I would like to walk the committee through the changes and where they are. Title changes to conform with the bill. Section 6, page 3, lines 18 through 28, amends AS 4305-225. It is the interest rate on delinquent taxes. Will now be compounded quarterly at 5% above the 12th Federal District for the first 4 years the tax becomes delinquent, and 5% with no compounding for the next 2 years. Section 10, page 5, lines 5 through 26, amends AS 4355-011E, deletes the reference to the Cook Inlet cap, which is repealed in Section 42 of the bill. Section 11, page 5, lines 6 through 26, amends AS 4355-011F, It hardens the floor so that no credits can reduce the floor below 2% of the gross value at the point of production. Section 12, page 8, lines 6 through 7, amends AS 43-55-011M. It takes out references to old credits that are not being used and deletes the reference to the Cook Inlet tax cap. Section 13 assures that the education tax credit cannot take the floor below 2%. That's on page 8, lines 13 through 18, and it amends section 43-55-019E. Section 14, pages 15 and 16, lines 1 through 3, amends AS 43-55-020A, installment payments, and its conforming language regarding payment of taxes and the new floor. It also addresses the Cook Inlet tax cap. Section 15, page 16, line 12, amends AS 43-55-023A, qualified capital expenditures. It reduces the qualified capital expenditure credits from 20% to 10% starting on January 1st, 2017. Section 16, page 17, lines 6 through 16, amends AS 43-55-023B, the net operating loss credits. It keeps Middle Earth credits consistent to hold harmless, reduces the Cook Inlet operating loss credits from 25 to 10% starting January 1st, 2017. And the amount of the Cook Inlet NOLs will stay consistent with the House Resources version. It will continue a 25% middle credit for Middle Earth after 2016. Section 17, page 17, lines 27 through 30, amends AS 43-55-023C, its conforming language to the floor. Section 20, page 19, lines 11 through 20, amends AS 43-55-023, I believe that's L, well lease expenditure credits, reduces the Cook Inlet well lease expenditure credits from 40% to 30% on January 1st, 2017, and to 20% on January 1, 2018. Sections 21 through 23, pages 19, lines 31 through 17, amends AS 43-55-024-F, G, and I. These are the small producer credits, and it conforms to the floor. Section 24, on page 20, lines 26 through 28, amends AS 43-55-025-M, Middle Earth drilling credits, and states that the Middle Earth drilling credits are extended to complete an exploration well that has been spudded but not completed before July 1st, 2016. Section 25, page 21, lines 26 through 29, amends AS 43-55-025, alternative credits for oil and gas exploration, and its conforming language to the floor. Section 26, page 22, lines 5 and 13, amends AS 43-55-028E, oil and gas tax credit fund, puts a new cap of $100 million in tax credits per person in a calendar year. This is a reduction from the $200 million in the House Resources version of the bill. Section 31, page 15, lines 11, 17, and 20. Can't be right, sorry. Amends AS 43-55-160E. It's a conforming amendment regarding the Cook Inlet tax cap on oil. Sections 32 and 33, which can be found on pages 25 through 27, lines 24 through 6, amends AS 4355-160G and F. This is new oil. New oil for oil first and gas first produced after December 31st, 2016. The new oil reduction shall apply for the first 5 years after the commencement of production of commercial quantities of oil and for oil first produced prior to January 1st, 2017. The reduction shall expire January 1st, 2021. These are the major changes in the bill. The other ones are conforming amendments so that things line up in the bill.
Okay. Briefity. Okay, we're back on the record. I am going to open it up to limited questions. Mr. Bullock can answer technical questions, but he can't talk about policy. And we will not have the Department of Revenue here till tonight. So if we're going to have questions from that, we will be coming back tonight to have additional questions asked. So we'll start out with questions. Mr. Bullock.
There's one thing I just want to emphasize, that the removal of the cook-in tax cap only applies to oil.
Right. Okay. Representative Garrett.
Thank you, Mr. Speaker. Mr. Chair, it went too fast for me to be able to compare the difference between some of the tax credit changes between this version and the governor's bill. So if that's what I'd like to focus on, if I could ask some questions.
Does that work?
It's been a while since I've looked at the governor's bill.
We'll give it a try.
Okay.
Representative Garrett.
Through the chair. Mr. Bullock, my understanding is, I guess, it's all separated between regions, so let's start with Cook Inlet. It's my understanding the governor's bill in Cook Inlet eliminated the capital lease expenditure, the 20% one, and the well lease expenditure of 40%. What does this do on the capital expenditure, the capital credit and the well lease expenditure credit?
Based on, Mr. Chairman, based on testimony from Analytica, they decided in the resources version here, to scale it down rather than to eliminate it.
Yeah, Analytica did state that we can't drop it all at once. It would be much better to step it down, and it would be more workable. Representative Guerra.
Thank you. So if you could then just explain, so the governor proposed to eliminate the 20% capital credit and the 40% well lease expenditure credit, and what does this bill do on those things?
Sorry, I just have to get there. And on page 16, on the qualified capital expenditure on line 11 is where it was reduced from 20% to 10%. And that's for the qualified capital expenditure. On the NOL scale down, it's on page 17. So it will continue at 25% in Middle Earth, and then but it'll go down to 10% inside the Cook Inlet sedimentary basin.
Actually, Department of Revenue will be here when we come back tonight, and probably asking questions on the governor's bill comparisons would be probably more directed towards the administration and Department of Revenue. If we're going to compare to the governor's version, it might be more easy to do at that time.
Okay, I can save those questions, Mr. Chair. Let me try a couple others on.
Go ahead, Representative Guerra.
Some easier ones then. Governor's bill did not let the tax go below the 4% tax floor. My understanding is this bill allows the tax to go down to 2%. Is that correct?
Yeah, Mr. Chairman, there's a two-step process. First, they'll calculate as to whether the minimum tax on gross applies, and if it applies, then you get to 4355.111F. And then if there are credits that would go below the 4%, there's a granite floor at 2% that the tax won't go before 2%.
All right, so through the chair. All right, so it sounds like the tax floor, you can't go below 2%. The governor said you can't go below 4, unless I've got that wrong.
I think the governor actually wanted a higher percentage
Yep. Through the chair, what is the change on the Cook Inlet oil tax?
Effective January 1st, 2017, Mr. Chairman, the tax cap on Cook Inlet oil goes away, and that's based on testimony that oil doesn't need the same incentives by limiting the tax that gas does.
So through the chair, what would the tax rate be?
It would be the same as the statewide rate, 35%.
Well, through the chair, not 35%, but the SB 21 rate, is that right?
What is the SB 21 rate? Isn't it 35%?
At $155 a barrel it is, yeah. But below that it's much lower. All right, we can go through that later. I don't think we'd have a lot of arguments if it was 35%. And so that's the SB 21, right? And then through the chair.
Representative Guerra.
I'm just trying to leave as many of these questions for tonight. There is a change. I think the governor's bill got rid of the exemption for what we call GVR fields, the post-2002 fields. The governor had so said those should be subject to the tax floor, and then it seems like this bill, after 5 years, makes them subject to the tax floor. Does it then at higher prices also go to the older oil tax rate?
Mr. Chairman, there's two different effects by the gross value reduction. One of them is added back in for the purposes of determining the net operating loss credit. And the second change regarding the gross value reduction limits the period in which the gross value reduction will apply.
And through the chair.
Representative Guerra.
And then after that 5 years, those fields then are treated as all the other fields in terms of the tax rate?
Well, it's safe to say that at least they're not subject to the gross value reduction.
For the chair, how's that not the same thing? Am I missing something? So,
after the oil, Mr. Chairman, after the oil no longer qualifies for the gross value reduction because the clocks run out, then there's no special distinction for that oil.
All right. Thank you. Those are my questions for now, Mr. Chair. Thank you.
Thank you, Representative Wilson.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Can you just tell me which sections on here have to do? The Cook Inlet ones are pretty easy. So anything that doesn't say Cook Inlet, to make the assumption that it's about SB 21, is that a good assumption, or it pertains to both? So I'm just really curious which ones of these that don't say Cook Inlet have to do with SB 21 and the North Slope.
SB 21 addressed the gross value reduction. It addressed a scaled down gross value tax as the minimum tax in 4355.011F. So the hard and hardened floor is a change. The changes having to do with the calculation of net operating loss has changed. Qualified capital expenditures are reduced, the 20 to the 10, that's a change. SB 21 affected the interest rate. This bill affects the interest rate.
And a follow-up?
Representative Wilson.
So I see on the interest rate, it does it for the first 4 years after the tax becomes delinquent, and the taxes really aren't delinquent. I mean, the companies pay the taxes, and if I understand it correctly, we're delinquent. I mean, we're the ones who decide which ones get audited, which ones don't. And so I just want to make sure that we're not making it seem like the companies are not filing what they need to. But just if you could just give me an explanation of why we came up with, and I'm asking for a policy call, just numbers-wise, how we did the first 4 years to become one and then no compounding after the first 4 years.
Yeah, Mr. Chairman, there was quite a discussion about the length of time it takes to complete the audits. And so one of the purposes of reducing the interest rate after the first period of time is to recognize the fact that it's a long time before the final tax is determined. And also, delinquency refers to the amount of tax that was due at the time. So it may be higher than what the taxpayer initially thought. And as delinquent is just kind of a tax term for it was due back in the original date if it had been filed in compliance the way that with the audit, as the audit ultimately decided what the amount was due. Similarly, for a person that's entitled to a refund, that rate will apply, and that would go back to the date of the overpayment in the same way that the interest on unpaid tax goes back to the original date in which it was due.
So this is basically an underpayment. It's a penalty for underpaying?
Right, underpayment based on the tax is finally determined. I mean, if a taxpayer reports an amount due and they don't pay it with their return, then the interest would start right there. But if the taxpayer reports everything and pays everything that they anticipate's due, and then a period of time later it's audited and it turns out they should have been paying more, then that's what the interest rate applies to.
Representative Wilson.
And this is probably a question to revenue, but just want to put on the record now in case we could get the answer before then is, do we audit every one of the companies? Because I know when we talk about the IRS, they don't audit all of us because they would need a lot more auditors, obviously. But it's something that it seems like we audit all the oil companies, you know, that come in, oil or gas, whichever ones it is. And I guess at some point, we do the same thing as the IRS, and anomalies would have to come out. We just don't do everybody.
I think you're right. That is a question for Department of Revenue tonight.
But that way maybe they could get it sooner and we could get an actual answer, not they'll get back to us.
Right. Okay. At this time, is there further questions from committee? Representative Munoz?
I just have a question about the fiscal notes. Will we have the updated fiscal notes?
That's why we're waiting for the Department of Revenue, who is in another meeting at this time. So when we come back tonight, they will have some fiscal impact information for us. It'll be forthcoming at that time.
Thank you.
Representative Guerra.
So one last question, Mr. Bullock, and if you don't know, you don't know, but the governor, in order to limit the state's deficit, tried to cap tax credits at $25 million per owner. You've got it at $100 million. I know the Resources Committee had it higher, but our understanding is almost no company ever claims more than 100, so is that really even a cap?
Mr. Chairman, it is a cap, and it also anticipates that there would be enough money in the oil and gas tax credit fund to pay it. If there isn't enough there, then the cap itself is irrelevant. That's a factual issue as to how much each person might be eligible to receive. And so I think you should address that to either the Department of Revenue or perhaps the taxpayers.
I do have one final question.
Representative Guerra.
And maybe this is for the Department of Revenue. Maybe you don't have the information. The the governor's bill's estimate was that it would have saved about $785 million. The resources version only saved about $20 million in FY17. Do you have any idea?
That's what the Department of Revenue is going to give us that fiscal information and impact tonight.
Sure. I can wait.
All right. Is there any further questions right now from committee? Seeing none, we're going to set this bill aside until later, and we are going to recess until 6:30 p.m. tonight. We are recessed. Okay, let's reconvene this meeting of the House Finance Committee and call it to order. Let the minutes reflect that it is 6:40 p.m. on Wednesday, April 6, 2016. We will reestablish our quorum. We have Representative Wilson, Representative Guerra, Representative Pruitt, Representative Kawasaki, Vice Chair Sadler, myself, Co-Chair Thompson. We have Co-Chair Newman, Representative Munoz, Representative Gaddis, and Representative Guttenberg. Before we start, please turn off your cell phones. No electronic devices allowed in committee. Okay, for the continuing today's schedule, we will continue with House Bill 247, Tax Credit Interest Refunds, Oil and Gas. Here from the Department of Revenue is the Director of the Tax Division, Mr. Ken Alper. He will answer questions on CSHB 247 Finance Version F. And also available for questions is Mary Hunter Gramling, Assistant Attorney General. Did I redo that wrong? Mr. Alper.
Good evening, Mr. Chairman. For the record, my name is Ken Alper. I'm the Director of the Tax Division at the Department of Revenue. Ms. Gramling is behind me and didn't know her name was going to get called out, so she was momentarily surprised. I'm here to answer general questions about the CS. I've gone through it a couple times. I think I understand it fairly well. My staff, the Tax Division, has provided a new document for the committee, which is a one-page table. I beseech you, Mr. Chairman, to not pin us down to this. I'm sure we got something wrong in there. We did this with about an hour and a half's notice, but this is the modeling of the various provisions of the bill. It's effectively the first draft of a fiscal note for the committee substitute. You may recognize the format. The most recent fiscal note provided by the Department of Revenue, approved by Jerry Burnett on the 29th of March, has a similar structure. It has two tables I'm holding up to show you. In it, one calibrated for the committee substitute from the Resources Committee. The other to the original bill is introduced by the governor. So this is a third version of the same table to the CS before you and the various subcomponents. I'm here at your pleasure.
Committee, you want to start with some questions? That was a quick meeting. Representative Guerra.
Seriously, nobody else has questions?
No. Representative Gutten, Representative Collins.
Okay, I'll start. Thanks for being here, Mr. Alper. I'm looking at the fiscal note dated the 29th. Total fiscal impact projections for the governor's bill is roughly between $770 to $805 million. This one says in the yellow line between $10 and $50 million total fiscal impact. Can you explain?
Through the chair, Representative Kawasaki, there, FY17 is the wrong data point, in my opinion, to use as the comparative. There are some aberrations in FY17, and the most substantial change between here and there is the change in the effective date. The great bulk of the changes proposed in the original version presented by the governor was July 1st of this year, whereas the great bulk of the changes in the committee substitute is in not until January 1st of 2017. So that itself wipes out half of FY17. And with the other changes and some oddities in the spending patterns in the current year, I wouldn't focus on that. To be a reasonable comparison, I would look at the out years where the various provisions in this bill are fully implemented.
Kawasaki.
Thank you. Then just looking in fiscal year 18, the value, the total fiscal impact according to the governor's bill that he introduced was between $420 and $455. This one is between $105 and $195. Departing from the variability, it looks to be less than half of what the total fiscal impact expected by the governor's bill. Is that about right then?
Through the chair, Representative Kawasaki, yes, I would say that. Let me just take a quick peek here. There are a couple of provisions. The largest difference in the values there is going to be related to the minimum tax. So the way the governor's original bill was presented was with a so-called hard floor at 5%. Meaning that all of the various credits that can currently reduce the minimum tax below the floor as low as zero we want to tighten that up and make them not usable. And then the proposal was to increase the floor to 5%. The committee substitute before you, I believe Mr. Bullock referred to a granite floor, a 2% floor for credits that could be credits could be used to offset the floor down to 2%, and then it hardens up at that. So it's a little bit of a half version, a really 40%. So the difference between the 5% floor in the governor's bill and the 2% floor in the version before you is the largest portion of the changes. Some of the cook inlet tax changes are there as well, but those are comparably much smaller dollar value items in the comparison between the bills.
Thank you,
Representative Kawasaki.
I'm good for now.
Thanks. Mr. Chair.
Okay. Representative Guttenberg.
Thank you. Thank you, Mr. Alper. I might get this wrong. And the net operating losses, the NOL, on the producers, those people producing more than 50,000 barrels, who have no tax, who have no profits because of the price of oil, and they cannot cash out their credits, and they are going to have a considerable amount of credits, and they can roll them forward. How does this, the version of that bill, change that, and from resources, the governor's to this one, to where we are now?
Thank you, through the chair, Representative Guttenberg. And we have not done that precise analysis for the draft fiscal note before you. We'll have it hopefully in a day or so when we finalize the document to go with this. But roughly speaking, and I spoke to the committee about this a couple of days ago, this is a new thing, a new phenomenon, where the major producers are suddenly losing money for the first time in at least modern Alaskan history, and specifically, they're losing money in an era of a net profits tax where they're earning a net operating loss credit. You are correct that you can't get cash from the state if you produce more than 50,000 barrels a day, that therefore your net operating loss credit is presumed to be carried forward and used against your taxes in the next year, and then the next year, and then the next year. In the analysis that we did for the spring revenue forecast, we estimated that by FY18-19, that'd be around $750 million in carried forward non-cashable NOLs from the major producers. So one of the things that this bill does by partially hardening the floor is to say, you know, what we're hardening it against is the majors using their NOLs to reduce their taxes below the 4%. So what that 750 that I just referenced represented was the amount that's left over after they wipe out the floor completely, get down to a number approaching zero in the production tax, and then they still have more NOLs to carry forward. What we're going to do is make that stack higher, because only some of the minimum tax could be offset, half of it, down to 2%. Therefore, some of those operating loss credits aren't being used to offset the floor. They're remaining in their pile with NOL credits. And judging by the fiscal note from the governor's original version, I would guess that about another $400-500 million worth of NOLs are going to be carried forward by the producers, and we're going to have $1 billion, maybe $1.2 billion worth of future credit liability that will be payable as an offset to taxes once the price goes back up.
So if I may,
Mr. Guttenberg.
Thank you. So you say $1 billion, $1.2 billion. What happens if we're in long-term below their profitability, which may, what is it, $60, $73? How far in advance can that keep rolling out? I call it a rolling wave.
Sure.
And I'm concerned about that and how we deal with that.
Through the chair, Representative Guttenberg, the break-even price, and every company is different and every year is different, and all we could do is come up with a sort of a stylized average company, average barrel. But based on the current estimates, it's closer to $46 a barrel. So below $46 a barrel, they're losing money. I mentioned that there's about 180 million barrels a year produced, 160 million taxable barrels. So every dollar you go below 46, that's 180 million or so dollars in operating losses times 35%, or maybe 75 million or so in operating loss credits, if you're just trying to keep a metric in your head over how fast these things stack up. So I think I did that about right. So if we have multiple years of the major producers in the state losing money, first off, who's to say how they'll react? This is something that that our economy is going to have to absorb in unknown ways. But as for the technical calculation of their operating loss credits, yes, that's a wave that will build and roll forward until, let's say you get a spike in oil, some catastrophic event happens on the other side of the world, and in 2020 the price of oil goes up to $125 a barrel. We might therefore be expecting to get $3 billion in the production tax, just to pull a number out of the air. That number, those credits would first be used to offset that production tax before we actually received any money.
Thank you.
From the production tax. The royalties, of course, would come in with the higher prices. I don't want to mischaracterize that.
Okay, I want to note that we've been joined in the audience by Representative Vasquez and Representative Wohl. Questions, Representative Guerra?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I do have some questions on, you know, the Senate. There's been a lot of discussion on this in the Senate about the net operating loss and maybe how it's bigger than folks thought it was. But just to understand, on the North Slope, under this bill and even the governor's bill, if you lose money, you get to deduct if you're a big producer or charge the state if you're a small producer. 35% of your loss, right? Is that how it works?
Yeah, through the chair, Representative Guerra, the net operating loss is just like it sounds. It's a loss. It means if you are not producing, it roughly means all your spending. If you're producing, but for some reason you're losing money because, say, the price of oil is very low, it would be your revenue minus your expenditures, meaning the negative number that is your loss, times the 35% credit rate. So 35% of that loss would be the credit earned. If you are cashable, if you're below 50,000 barrels, you would apply to the state for a refundable credit subject to appropriation. If not, it enters this pile of carry-forward credits that the major producers are starting to accumulate.
Representative Guerra.
Thank you. So let's talk about the ones that we're paying with cash. If you produce less than 50,000 barrels a day, whether you make money or not, but let's say you're not making money, you're a new company. The 35% is basically we're paying 35% of all their costs, all their operating costs, all their capital costs, right?
Through the chair, Representative Guerra, yes, that the by far the largest portion of the credits we buy on the North Slope for the last many years have been exactly what you said, operating loss credits.
And through the chair?
Representative Guerra.
Just so we can get a sense of how much we're paying for those, for the companies that can cash out their credits, so companies that produce 50,000 barrels or less, or companies that are losing money and not producing, how much annually can we be expected to have to pay? Forget about only paying a portion and rolling them forward. Actually, that's just the big producers. How much for those 50,000 barrel a day and smaller and money-losing companies are we going to be paying with a 35% net operating loss credit? Let's say this past year, this current year, and next year.
Are we talking North Slope?
North Slope, yeah.
North Slope. Through the chair, Representative Guerra, the NOL portion of North Slope refunded credits, and I don't have a – the number in FY15 was $203 million. The number in FY16 is going to be similar, around $200. The estimate in FY17 is in the neighborhood of about $325. I don't have there's been some modification between the preliminary spring and the final spring forecast, which we'll be delivering to the legislature tomorrow. But I think the number is about $325. And then the FY18 number will be about $250 million.
Through the chair.
Representative Guerra.
So $200, $225, $250, and then in years out beyond that, it's just guesswork, I guess?
Through the chair, Representative Garrett, it's a little more than guesswork, but it's much less precise, and our numbers they tend to increase as you get closer to the present day because we know more about company activity 1 year from now than we do about what we know 4 years from now. But a good, you know, we have about 150 built into the forecast, but we expect those to go up.
Through the chair.
Representative Garrett.
So for the North Slope, for those, let's just call them smaller and new companies, we're paying between $200 and $325 million a year in these 4 years. in the coming years, the production tax that we're taking in, according to your forecast, is somewhere in the $15 to $60 million range. Is that fair?
Through the chair, Representative Gary, yes, that's what the forecast says. The legislation before you would change that. The hardening, the so-called 2% floor. If you look at the fiscal notes here, you're seeing numbers beginning in FY18 of $70 to $100 million, say. That would show up as revenue, as production tax revenue, increasing the number in our current forecast.
And then through the chair.
Representative Gary.
But even with those numbers, we're expected to pay more in cashable net operating loss credits than we're getting back in production taxes in the years in the future you've predicted.
Through the chair, Representative Guerra, yes. So the forecast does not include the rest of the bill. So I'm looking at multiple pieces of paper at the same time. In addition to adding the revenue, we need to subtract the credits. But yes, I believe we're still going to be a scenario where, at best, the production tax on the North Slope will be something of a break-even to the state.
And through the chair.
Representative Guerra.
And then the other thing that's getting more discussion has been the net operating losses that we pay to the major producers, the ones who produce more than 50,000 barrels a day. We don't pay them. They just deduct those from their taxes as far as they can, and if they can't deduct all of them under our minimum floor rules, they roll them forward. So for the major producers, forecast maybe for this and next year, what do they get a credit for? 35% of, to explain, what's the dollar value for that?
In calendar year 2015, for the first time, we saw major producers, at least one, I've testified, with an operating loss. Not enough to completely offset taxes, but enough to make an impact. And our forecast for was that about, what was the number, $23 million worth of credits was going to be used to offset taxes in FY15 and $95 million in FY16, $95 million in FY17. You know, those were the operating loss credits from the major producers reducing some of the minimum tax. That number by FY18 increases to $150 million and more, meaning that's roughly all of the minimum tax coming from the major producers on the legacy production in the North Slope. So that gets completely offset. So when I responded to Representative Guttenberg's question that there was going to be, say, 750 carried forward, that means they might have had 900 of them and used 150 to wipe out the minimum tax and then carried forward the next 750.
Through the chair.
Representative Guerra.
Let's just talk about, let's say, FY17 and FY18, if you can predict those. Let's forget about if they could take them all in 1 year. What's the value of these net operating loss credits, the 35% net operating loss credit to the majors?
Sure, and to clarify, any of the credits that were earned in 2015 were actually earned at the 45% level because of that temporary bump in the NOL that was built into Senate Bill 21. That was a two-year temporary increase in the NOL. But our estimate is that the total value of non-carried forward NOLs, meaning non-carry-forwardable, the major producers' NOLs, is $385 million at the end of FY16.
Through the chair.
Representative Guerra.
Just so I can understand, that $300-something million dollars is what was earned in that fiscal year?
Earned by the end of fiscal year 16, yes, based on our estimates of how their performance will be through this June.
And through the chair, just
Representative
Guerra. And for FY17, just the flat earned amount, forget about what has to be rolled over to future years. For FY17 and FY18, what's the estimate?
I just want to confirm, as I look at the estimate chart in front of me, that's a total, but it includes the ones from the prior year because they keep rolling forward. The end of FY17 number is 635. That really means about 250 more than existed at the end of FY16. And then FY18, our number is 766. which is about 135 more than existed at the end of FY17.
And so I understand, Mr. Chair. So for FY17, you expect them to earn an additional $250 million of new NOL credits, and in FY18 you expect them to earn an additional $100-something million of NOL credits?
Through the Chair, Representative Guerra, that's correct.
That's it for now, Mr. Chair.
Okay, Representative Wilson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Okay, so talking about North Slope, we're talking about Cook Inlet, and they kind of seem to be going together again. So we keep talking about how much money we owe for this year. And isn't there a difference between the amount of credits that are available that have been sent in and how much that we are actually required to pay?
Through the Chair, Representative Wilson, yes, very much so. The conversation I just had, the exchange I just had with Representative Garrett, was on the topic of the non-refundable ones, the major producers. The conversation that the bulk of what this bill has been about the refundable ones, the ones that the other companies get. And then that's the number where you see the forecast, and is it 775, is it 825? And then there's your question of how much do we have to repay? Now, there's the statutory guideline in the tax credit fund language that says a relatively small number at low prices. The history, the tradition of the legislature in modern times has been to fund the amount requested. But ultimately, every year, that is an appropriation issue. It's a number in the operating budget. It's in the language section under fund capitalization. And it is at the will of the legislature and the governor to decide what that number is going to be.
Follow up, Mr. Chair.
Representative Wilson.
Okay, so my frustration here is all we hear about is our investment in it, but it's like there's no return on our investment, okay? And I'm assuming, since we've had pretty good budgets in the last past years, that the return on our investment has been pretty good. Would you not agree with that?
Well, through the Chair, Representative Wilson, I had a few slides in my presentation about a week ago before this committee that tried to calculate the new barrels that were associated with the fields that have received refundable tax credits to give a sense for the scope and the order of magnitude. I think that's a more fair discussion of return on investment. Most of the money that has come in during the years of high budgets and high revenue is from legacy production, the oil fields that were already in production in some cases 30 years ago. But the price of oil went up, and the state got a bit of a windfall from high royalties and high production taxes.
Follow up, Mr. Chair.
Representative Wilson.
Well, you may see it as a windfall, sir, but I think, you know, if we had not made the investments at the time through other kinds of tax credits, maybe not the same ones we have now, that is the windfall in hopes of having more oil. So if I remember correctly, as we went through SB 21, and we had a lot of charts, but one of the charts, remember more than any of the others, is that we knew the next couple of years were going to be the highest years when it came to tax credits, because some of them still had to do with all these other tax credits before my time, so I'm not to blame, okay? And so how do we now distinguish, I mean, are we now in the tax credits that we're talking about here, talking about only SB 21 and the tax credits come from there, or some of the tax credits, the ones, and I'm talking about the refundable ones at this point, are they still based on other previous tax credits? And then could you distinguish between the Cook Inlet cashable ones and the North Slope cashable ones? I'm pretty sure I know both answers, but just trying to make sure.
Let's get it all on the record. Through Please. The Chair, Representative Wilson. The Cook Inlet answer is easy because Senate Bill 21 did not touch or impact Cook Inlet taxes or credits in any way. It was entirely and exclusively a North Slope bill. So the credits that we're paying out in Cook Inlet are the old 25% operating loss credit, which is really part of ACES at that rate, the capital expenditure credit, which is part of PPT from 2006, the 40% well lease expenditure credit, which is part of the Cook Inlet Recovery Act of 2010,
And I'm writing as fast as
you're actually, wow, thank you, Mr. Chairman.
That's I'm trying really hard.
The capital credit was part of the PPT bill, the 20% capital credit, 2006. The well lease expenditure credit is a 40% credit that was part of the Cook Inlet Recovery Act of 2010. And let's not neglect the exploration credits, which were part of a standalone bill that passed in 2003, way back in the ELF era. So the refundable credits in Cook Inlet are those. They are all pre-SB 21 credits. On the North Slope, the part of those charts that we saw was a transition on the refundable side where the old capital credit that was part of PPT and extended through ACES was being accelerated, that companies were going to be allowed to take a credit in 1 year that traditionally had been taken in two in that last year. So effectively, 1.5 years' worth of credits were earned in 1 year, and then they went away. At the same time, on the North Slope, you see the small amount of exploration credits, which are still from that old 2003 law, and then there's the net operating loss. The net operating loss credit is an old concept. It goes all the way back to PPT, but the idea that it's 35 or 45% is unique to Senate Bill 21. But to your question over what are we amending, the bill as proposed and the bill as amended do not change the net operating loss credit on the North Slope. That is what it is, 35% going forward. We have not, at least currently, proposed changing it, although with this new land of rolling waves, I can imagine that conversation picking up perhaps in the other body where they're talking about it more aggressively.
Follow up.
Representative Wilson.
Well, thank you for making our point that we have obviously changed so many times that I can't even tell you all the acronyms. So if we were just in SB 21, and let's say all the rest of this didn't exist, what tax credits could be cashed in today?
If, through the chair, Representative Wilson, if SB 21 were a statewide law and there was no this hodgepodge of other pieces left over in Cook Inlet now, and there is no production anyplace else for all our Middle Earth credits, they're still all at the exploration and, to a lesser extent, the development level. So Cook Inlet, if Cook Inlet had SB 21, they would get cashable the net operating loss credit at whatever level the law was. And how that would compare to what they're earning today, I couldn't tell you off the top of my head.
Mr. Chairman, yeah. Let me ask my question different because that was not what I meant. Sorry.
Representative Wilson, rephrase your question.
Thank you. Okay, back to Juno talk. Okay, so if we're talking, if the tax credits today just on the North Slope was just SB 21, because like you said, we still have some ACES coming in, we still got PPT and all the rest. If we were just talking about the tax credits, you know, on the North Slope, only SB 21 had anything to do with, how much of that would be cashed in today underneath that?
Okay. Through the chair, Representative Wilson, on the North Slope.
North Slope.
Because we have, what we have in the North Slope are these NOLs, which we're deciding are part of 21, because 21 raised the NOL, and an NOL is an inherent integral part of 21. And then we have some of these exploration credits. We anticipate paying about $67 million in exploration credits in FY17 on the North Slope. Now, those credits are a bit of a spike, a bit of a high, in large part, at least from our own internal analysis, because those credits are about to sunset. So we have a unique historical moment where companies are saying, wait a second, I can get 85% credits on an exploration well in the North Slope if I drill it in 2015. And that number 85 is a 40% exploration credit plus a 45% operating loss credit. A rational company would say, you know, if I was going to drill that well any time in the next 10 years, let's drill it in 2015 because I'm going to get an 85% credit. So we're seeing a little bit of that in terms of a spike right now, calendar year 15, because of those sunsetting credits, absolutely.
And a follow-up?
Representative Wilson.
And the net operating loss ones that we're talking about, that comes off their taxes or what they owe the state. Those are not ones that they're cashing in for us to write a check to them.
Through the chair, Representative Wilson, no, except for the major producers, the major producers don't get cash for anything, but the non-major producers can get cash for everything. So their NOLs are, in fact, cashable, and that's that $340 million number that I quoted for FY17.
And one,
Representative Wilson.
Thank you. And so could you just briefly tell me, so with the 2% floor now that's in this bill, and if I had more credit, that would put me below the 2%, would those credits be able to go to the next year, or do I just lose them because it goes below the 2% floor?
Through the chair, Representative Wilson, the NOLs would go forward to the next year. To the extent we are talking about the SB 21 per barrel credits, those are use them or lose them credits, and they wouldn't carry forward. To the extent we're talking about small producer credits, which is something, and these are credits against liability. Those are both credits that you have to use to reduce your taxes. They're not cashable, the small producer and the per barrel credit. So those are what you would call use them or lose them. They can't be carried forward, they can't be cashed, they can't be transferred.
So if I understand correctly, Mr. Chairman,
Wilson,
this could have a pretty negative effect on what's happening. If it's a use it or lose it type, you can't carry it forward, then this could definitely be a game changer as far as what anyone decides to go forward with.
Through the chair, Representative Wilson, I'm not sure what the word this is in your question. Those are current law. None of those credits have ever been cashable. They carry the per barrel credit or the small producer credit. The one change being made in this bill that impacts any of that is specifically for new fields. The per barrel credit of $5 a barrel earned by new producers in what you'd call a GVR eligible field. Currently, those could be used to reduce taxes down to zero. The bill as written would bring those to the new 2% hard floor. That is an uncreditable, unrecoverable tax increase on those producers.
Perfect. That's what I was talking about.
Okay.
Representative Pruitt.
Yeah. Thank you, Mr. Chair. Mr. Alper, I have a couple questions. One of the things, though, I wanted to ask you about is when Representative Wilson had asked about the benefit of the credits and some of the things that we've done, you pointed to your slide the other day and said that most of the production was coming from the legacy wells. What I need to understand, if that's the truth, we just heard in the paper that for the first time in many years we had an increase in production. How does that fit with that none of the things that we have put in place and the credits that we have put forward with the attempt of putting more oil in the pipeline? There's more oil in the pipeline. How does that mesh?
Sure. Through the chair, Representative Pruitt, if you look at the forecast documents that we put out as part of the revenue source book, there's always a bunch of wedges that stack on top of each other. The currently producing oil, the underdevelopment oil, and then the idea of under evaluation, the oil that's a little bit more conditional that we wait or risk to see what's going to come in. So the currently producing oil has a natural decline rate, of course. All existing wells decline, and then there's inevitably a certain amount of infill drilling in the legacy fields that also is considered to be legacy oil, although many could consider that new. If you have a producing field and you simply drill a new well in the middle of it where you know the oil is producing just to increase your own efficiency, that's not generally considered new. It certainly doesn't qualify for the GVR. From our look at the numbers, and there's no reason to say that it's not a great thing that production went up last year. Production did go up. By far the largest component of that would be a relatively substantial new field that began production last year at CD5, Conoco's new field across the Colville River. The numbers I've heard informally are up to 16,000 barrels a day coming out of that field. If, in fact, production increased about 1%, I think that's what I read last year, or out of 500,000 barrels a day, so that's about 5,000-barrel increase, 15,000 from this one new field, so the rest of the North Slope would therefore have declined at about 10,000 barrels a day in the last year. Mr.
Representative Pruitt.
Yeah, but if they had not been investing, so the NOLs, this is where they come into play. If they had just allowed the normal decline to take place, we would have seen a decline last year of the 10%, of which the 16,000 you just highlighted would not have been able to bring that up. So the NOLs, the investments that they take, and in this case, the losses that they would accrue, and therefore be able to put towards their tax liability, that that actually stemmed the decline. So I think there's kind of, by indicating that the items that are out, the investments that we've made through the tax credits have not really added new oil. Maybe it did come from the same field, but if it did, if we had not made those investments and encouraged those investments, we wouldn't have had that oil.
Through the chair, Representative Pruitt, yes, I agree with you. There is a substantial amount of new oil, and the case could be made as to what is the total share of that oil versus the legacy oil. And 9% of our current production is eligible for the GVR. Some larger number than that could be considered new, but maybe not for one reason or another eligible for the GVR. In the specific case of CD5, that's a great example because it was primarily developed by ConocoPhillips, who is one of our major producers. The money that was spent on that field was spent not just in the current years of fiscal crisis, but in years where they, we should hope, had robust profits because the price was higher. That spending didn't show up on the credit side of the ledger. It simply showed up as a reduction in tax liability because it was an offset against their profits. Now, this is the more fundamental decision the legislature made in 2006 when you switched to a net profits tax. You know, from that moment forward, the idea was we want to encourage companies to reinvest their profits in Alaska and invest in new fields. And the way we'll do that is to not charge taxes on that share of their revenue that they reinvest and spend in something new. There are some efficiencies in that. There are some inefficiencies, especially at low prices in that. But in that case, at least, it has most definitely been successful. Conoco reinvested their profits. They did not pay taxes on that money. Instead, they used it to build a new field, and now we are enjoying 16,000 barrels a day of increased production.
Yeah, Mr. Chair, and I have another question, but I'll just in that conversation with highlighting or pointing out that I think you just hit on why we continue with this uncertainty, and that is that we changed from the gross to this high level of net, and to offset the high level on the net, we've decided that we're going to do the credits. And once we started complicating it for what we thought was going to be our own benefit, we've created this haphazard system that we have in place. The questions I really had initially, though, before I had heard that, was related to just kind of interpretation of the bill and some questions that I would have in how you would perceive a couple of the things we've highlighted in here. We have $100 million per company limit. If a company were to hit that limit, would it be your intent to pay that $100 million as the tax guy for the state, or would you keep it at the $73.5 million or whatever it may be, whatever the formula comes out to, statutory number? Is all of our ups and downs and $25 million, $100 million, $500 million not matter if you're going to continue to keep the statutory number of 73.5 as the max for which that you'll pay out?
Through the chair, Representative Pruitt, in some ways you're asking me to read the governor's mind, and I don't know that I'm comfortable going there. The idea of the legislation from the beginning was to reduce the footprint, to reduce the annual size of the credit program so that we could reduce the appropriation to something we can afford. The bill before you is somewhere in between what was originally proposed and what came to this committee from the prior committee. If that's what moves the needle to the point where the governor is comfortable appropriating the full amount of the credits, then it is. I don't know for certain. Obviously, this bill, we've only seen this bill for a couple of hours, just like you.
Okay. But
Representative Pruitt.
But there was a previous version that had $200 million. So I guess that goes back into, and I know that I'm not talking to the governor because I don't expect that I'm going to be talking to the governor sitting in front of here. You're it, buddy.
I'm doing
it. Or that guy right behind you. And so so since you two are the best I can get,
yes,
that's what I'm going to ask. You're here speaking for the governor, in essence. And so we can talk about the $25 million cap. We can talk about the $100 million cap. I want to know,
are you going to pay no more than the statutory discussion that we've heard this whole year? What should we make sure that we expect in the future? We can dance all around this. We can put different numbers. I need to know, what are you guys going to pay out?
If I can take a brief at ease. Back on the record, Commissioner Hoffbeck, place yourself on the record, please.
Thank you, Chairman Thompson. For the record, Randy Hoffbeck, Commissioner of Revenue. Through the chair, Representative Pruitt, I think the answer to your question is twofold. First is how much will the legislature appropriate to pay the credits, because obviously we can't pay credits with money that hasn't been appropriated by the legislature. The second is, how much will the governor leave in the appropriation at the end? And that, he's basically said, is largely dependent upon what the entire package looks like when it's done. The credits, the Permanent Fund Protection Act, other taxes, expenditure reductions. He's basically said he's going to wait till he sees what the whole package looks like. So.
Thank you, Commissioner.
Okay, one more question. Lastly, one thing, and this is about the bill. You said you've only seen it for the last couple hours, and this is pretty detailed for having only seen it for the last 3 hours. Have you been able to – could you answer this question, or should I ask this to the sponsor? The $100 million cap, if they have $110 million worth of liability, is that $10 million automatically roll over to the next year? I mean, I guess NOLs – should, but what about some of the other credits?
Through the chair, Representative Pruitt, it's good that you asked the question, because I want to clarify what, once you get to the place where we're repurchasing credits, or we're actually repurchasing our certificates, you know, and if the company is eligible to have their certificates repurchased, meaning that they're not one of the major producers, the refundable credits are not use it or lose it. Answering Representative Wilson's question earlier, I was talking about those only credits that could be used against liability. Some of those are use them or lose them. So yes, absolutely, if a company has $110 million, or for that matter $500 million in credits, and there is a cap, they would be able to earn those, they would be able to cash those in the next year. You saw some of that in those modeling slides, the example modeling slides, where you saw kind of $25 million across the line for 4 or 5 years in a row as companies were working through their credits in the so-called after scenarios as we implemented the governor's version of the bill. They are not lost.
Okay. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Representative Munoz. Okay.
So thank you, Mr. Chairman. So we heard that the companies are urging that we stay the course for this current year, this current financial year, and then in Cook Inlet, the credits, could be tapered off after that. That's not what they said, but that essentially they were really committed to this year. And looking at FY17, FY18, FY16, FY17, that's a fiscal year. So how does that work? Where the company, I mean, they're working on a different calendar year financially than we are. What portion of that FY17 credit toward Cook Inlet is committed in this financial year? Does that make sense? I know our budget goes out till July 1st of the next year.
So through the chair, Representative Munoz, the bill as before you now, the committee substitute, most of the sections have an effective date of January 1st of 2017. So all of the credits that are earned for the rest of this year, as they're earned and as they're cashed, are unchanged. So what we're seeing is some of the credits that might be earned in the first 6 months of next year, January through June, which are FY17, might in some way impact the FY17 calculations. And that's why, whatever the impact is, if you look at this fiscal note chart I brought in, the numbers are much smaller in FY17 than in all the other years, in large part because it's only half a year. You're only dealing with either half or less, depending on the nature of the credit and how it's cashed, of the impact is going to be felt in that first year, FY17. And the bulk of the impact isn't seen where all the provisions are fully implemented until FY18.
Representative Munoz?
So then getting to the numbers specifically, it looks like the changes in this latest CS, the largest impact is on the North Slope when we were trying to find greater impact in the Cook Inlet. So looking at your revenue numbers for Cook Inlet, we have FY17 at $414 million, $162 million in 18, eventually going to $100 million in FY20. What is the actual amount, estimated based on these changes that we will be paying in credits to Cook Inlet during that time frame?
Through the chair, I apologize, Representative Munoz. You were reading numbers, and I'm not quite sure from where they were coming. So if you could help me find that, I'll give you better context.
From your revenue spring forecast book, I'm taking
the credit spend. Okay.
Yeah.
All right.
And I'm looking at these new numbers and trying to figure out what will be committed in Cook Inlet based on these changes.
So, Representative Munoz, through the chair, the number for FY17, say $414 million. These are refunded credits in total, $162 million. Those numbers would be reduced in large part. The budget impact rose so that the fiscal note before you is really two different things. There's an increase in revenue kind of above that midpoint line that shows up as more money, and then below that is reduced spending. So we're below the line in the reduced spending, and the first two lines where it says budget impact and change of NOLs and Cook Inlet and then QCEWLE and Cook Inlet, so the first two lines. And in FY18, you see a 10 to 20 and then a 15 to 25. So if you were to take the midpoint of those two numbers and add them up, that would be about $35 million. So we would be whatever the number, and then so here's $35 million. Then let's go to our total anticipated credit spend in Cook Inlet for FY18 is $162 million. So you would reduce that by the 35.
By $35 million. But yet we're taking a much bigger we're generating much more revenue with this change on the North Slope.
Through the chair, Representative Munoz, on the revenue side of the ledger, there's three things happening. Two of them until the change that where you're reintroducing an oil tax in Cook Inlet. Realistically, there's only so much oil volume in Cook Inlet, and the prices are low, and there also is no minimum tax in Cook Inlet. So the dollar value of that is a positive number, at least, but we're only estimating anywhere up to $10 or $15 million a year, up in, at least until you get to 2021. The numbers are a little bit higher. The most of the value is in the North Slope, of course. So if we're hardening the floor, to use the term of art we've been using, all of the impact of that's going to be felt in the North Slope just because that's where the money is. And then the third piece, which is a little bit more esoteric, is this idea of the gross value reduction impacting the operating loss credit, that unanticipated circumstance Mr. Meyer was talking about it. That by correcting that is only limited to the North Slope simply because the GVR, the new oil benefit, is part of SB 21 and doesn't exist elsewhere in the state. So inevitably, the value's in the North Slope, the money's in the North Slope, and to a certain extent, there'll be the
bulk of the impact on the North Slope.
Okay, and so Mike
Representative Newman had a question on just that point.
On that point, okay.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Ken, you mentioned $15 million in value of oil and cooking. At what price and how many barrels? How many barrels are we producing now? And
sure.
You base that $15 million on?
Mr. Co-Chair, the about 15,000 barrels a day, 18,000, somewhere in that number is the production from the north, from Cook Inlet. Just to do the simple math, if you multiply that times the year and then you subtract out the royalty barrels, roughly one-eighth, there's just about 5 million taxable barrels a year produced in the North Slope. I'm sorry, in Cook Inlet, but 5 million taxable barrels a year in Cook Inlet. Our forecast prices are bleak. They're low, you know, $40-odd dollars for the next several years, moving up into the 60s by about 2021. But based on those prices and to what we know about spending, lease expenditures on the oil in Cook Inlet, we're going to get about $10 million a year in production tax.
Representative Munoz.
Okay, and just one final thought, though, in conclusion. I think from our testimony and from the consultant that we heard from, really the issues were in Cook Inlet and trying to deal with kind of a situation where the Cook Inlet is probably properly incentivized and is meeting the goals that were set out originally, but that maybe now we're paying too many credits in Cook Inlet. But if we're only getting 25 to 30 million in the credits in Cook Inlet with this change, I don't know if that gets us to where we were intending to go. So anyway, we'll continue to work on it, but thank you for answering those questions.
Over here. Representative Gaddis.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I actually don't have any questions for them. I'll be waiting to get into the policy calls when we get there. Thank you.
Mr. Chair, I do on that point.
Representative Pruitt.
Can you tell me how much of the 15,000 to 18,000 barrels that comes out of Cook Inlet is used in Alaska and how much potentially goes outside of Alaska?
Through the chair, Representative Pruitt, I'm probably not your best expert on that, but it's my understanding that all of it is refined in Alaska. It goes to one or another of Alaska's refineries, and to my knowledge, what they produce for the most part is consumed in Alaska as well. But that includes the airport and all that. Commissioner Hoffbeck might have a little insight into that.
Commissioner?
Through the chair, Representative Pruitt, yeah, I believe it's 100% of it is used in Alaska.
So, Mr. Chair.
Representative Pruitt.
So on that point, $10 million more, how is that going to impact Alaskans then? I mean, how? Obviously those companies it's going to impact their profit. It's going to impact, I mean, there's a flow through somehow. What do we see the results of the additional $10 million having on both that investment in the Cook Inlet and then subsequently, how will it impact like at a Tesoro? I mean, are they going to be able to maintain their prices at the same level, or are we going to see an increase in gas or heating fuel or whatnot if we increase that tax in the Cook Inlet?
Chair Representative Pruitt, it's hard to say what will be absorbed by the company, what will be passed through to their customers. To put the numbers in order of magnitude, if we're talking about 5 million barrels of oil and $10 million, about $2 per barrel. If there's 40 gallons of various products coming out of a barrel of oil, it's about 5 cents a gallon worth of a tax associated with every gallon of product across the board. Some of that's there's a wide range in product values, but if you're going to make a very rough metric, that's where I would start.
Mr.
Chair.
So, let's put this in perspective. There's a bill in front of us that's going to raise fuel tax by 8 cents. It's going to raise jet fuel by almost 7 cents, et cetera, et cetera. So now there's another 5 cents on that. So instead of just 8 cents to the consumer in terms of the cost of filling up with a gallon of gas to your car, it's really more like we're looking at a 13-cent increase with just our tax that we'll be placing on the Cook Inlet, as well as the tax that if we were to go forward with the tax, the motor vehicle tax. Is that probably a good assessment of what the public or what they should expect if we were to go forward with both of those measures?
Through the chair, Representative Pruitt, I'm going to follow up first on the question that you'd that Director Alper asked answered. Oil, it's a waterborne commodity coming out of Cook Inlet. They can sell it in Kenai. They can sell it in now that they can export it. They can sell it in China. They can sell it anywhere. They're going to sell it wherever they can get the highest price minus the transportation costs. So the fact that there's a credit there or not is not going to affect the price that they sell the oil for. The market is going to determine the price of the oil. So if the credit is there and they're still making a profit, the credit's going to go to the bottom line for the corporation. They're not going to cut Tesoro a deal because they've got the credit. So,
And thank you, Mr. Chair. And I guess the other part that we really haven't been able to highlight is of course, now we've had a little bit of a discussion on the potential impact to the consumer. I don't know that there's any modeling that we've seen, especially because this is a new bill, that can talk about the impact that it may have to the investment within Cook Inlet. And, that's a whole other discussion. That could eliminate the $10 million in tax anyways if there's not investment taking place in the Cook Inlet. But that's more of a statement, Mr. Chair, than a question. But I don't think there's modeling on this, and that's I will say that's a little concerning. That's kind of the.
Thank you, Representative Pruitt. Representative Guerra.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I'm really going to try and limit this to questions, but on one of the things that Representative Pruitt talked about, which is the development of CD5, which started one way at ACES, and we talked about all the exploration credits and the credits we were paying. The conscious decision back then was we had a very high tax, and at very high prices, we understood we would try and reinvest that into credits. But we don't have a high tax anymore, so I hope people consider that as they decide what to pay in credits. Mr. Alper, I'm trying to total all of the credits for FY17. And tell me if I have this right. For FY17, we have, for the North Slope, roughly $325 million of cashable credits. These are the ones that are accruing in FY17. $325 million in cashable credits, $250 million in non-cashable bigger producer credits. That's like $575 million. And then from what I heard, somewhere about $130 million of credits in Cook Inlet under this bill. So like $700 million of credits we're still left with. Is my math close?
This is the Chair, Representative Guerra. I would need to redo the math myself. The estimate for total credit spend in FY17, and once 17 is a hard year because we're in the middle of a fiscal year with the effective date of a bill, but we're looking to reduce the spend only by about $20 million in FY17 with the CS before you, just because there's not a lot of change if the CS kicks in late in the year. But so the estimate credit spend, which I know the piece of paper you're looking at, which is a couple weeks old, said 825. The final version of it will say 775. That's the new number for the spring forecast, given the more accurate data that we got from the final tax payments last week. Setting that aside, that number is going to get adjusted. Our credit obligation is going to be 750, roughly, with the changes made by the bill. Then there is another $150 million in credits against liability. That is the credits that offset the minimum tax, the small producer credit, per barrel credits there still are, and then there's this universe of $300 million in carried forward credits that are not cashable. So that gets us to $1.1 billion or so by my calculation.
And through the chair,
Representative Guerra.
And then so FY18, I guess you said that might be a more accurate year. The accrued credits for that year, my understanding, on the North Slope, roughly $250 million in cashable credits, roughly $130 million of accrued credits by the bigger producers, and then I don't know what Cook Inlet would be. So are we still at over with this bill, are we still at over $500 million in credits in Cook Inlet and the North Slope accrued? Forget about rolling stuff forward.
So we the revised FY18 estimate and the final spring forecast will be 500. The midpoint, you know, the bill here has some ranges, and we're saying between 35 and 85 of budget impact. So let's split that difference and call it 60. So 500 becomes 440, and then there's another 150 in the uncashable credits. So that's 590, and then the 205 million credits against liability. So about $800 million. Plus, to offset, there's also an additional $100 million in taxes through the hardening of the floor. So that would, I don't know where to calculate it, but that would be a subtraction if you're looking at some aggregate obligation.
Through the chair.
Representative Guerra.
Yeah, you said 590, but then you added another 200. What was that additional 200?
The 200 is the so-called credits against liability. The what we estimate the credits that will be reducing the minimum tax, the small producer credit, and the per barrel credit.
And that, and under, through the chair, under all versions, the small producer credit's disappearing. Is that right?
The small producer credit is disappearing slowly over the next 9 years. There are companies who, the way the small producer credit, and I saw Representative Guerra a look of some confusion or shock, so I'm going to go back up a step on this one. The small producer credit is written to say that to use it, you have to earn it by May 1st, 2016. That's been in the law since PPT 10 years ago. So for those companies who got the small producer credit in 2008, say, if they started production then, their ninth year is 2016, and they're done now. They won't be able to get it anymore. But if a company starts production, their very first production for that company, not a new field but a new company, this year by May 1st, which is 3 weeks from now, then they can collect it for the next 9 years. So the last small producer credits will be earned in 2024, I believe.
Okay. Two other.
Representative Guerra.
Chair, thank you. By limiting the tax, the annual tax credit to $100 million, Governor had proposed $25 million, Resources Committee proposed $200 million. But by allowing up to $100 million per company, is that going to limit it for very many companies out there? I mean, aren't most of the credits going to fall within that $100 million per company cap?
Through the chair, Representative Guerra, I previously testified anecdotally that in our history of paying tax credits, there have been six instances where a company has received more than $100 million in a single year through the current year. There's a couple of others, I believe, stacked up in FY17, but they would not be impacted by this bill because of the effective date. So we don't have any large credits that we're aware of, large investments in the next 2 or 3 years that would hit that $100 million threshold. So we did not have a positive number in the fiscal note tied to that provision of the bill.
And finally, through the chair.
Representative Guerra.
Thank you. I mean, I think we've got to have tax revenue that enables us to afford $800 million of tax credits. And so let me ask you this. I mean, I think I know the answer. I think I've said it, but let me see if I'm right. We're basically living with a tax that is a 4% gross tax. Under this bill, it can go down to 2% with deductions, but it's essentially a 4% gross tax under this bill. And the way the law is written, for the average field on the North Slope, will that last until about $76 a barrel? Is that, am I right about that?
To clarify, through the chair, Representative Guerra, based on our current estimates of costs and other variables like that, the crossover point at which the gross tax inflects and starts paying at the normal 35% tax with the per barrel credit is at about $76 a barrel for legacy for production, for old oil. Yes.
Thank you, sir. I don't want to keep people here. I don't think we can live with that. I'm going to afford it.
Representative Wilson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and thank you for a second bite of the apple here. So we were talking about taxing oil in Cook Inlet, which is a little different than on the North Slope because of the ability to actually be able to bring in to refine from the lower 48 or for somewhere else. I know that was a big deal with Flint Hills, as Flint Hills had to try to compete with royalty oil that we made way too much off of, and we saw how that worked to a point to where literally they could import refined product cheaper than what we could refine it here. So as we're looking at the potential of now taxing oil in the Cook Inlet, do you have any idea price-wise when we would tip the scale to where they could actually bring in not just oil to refine, but actually the product, and again jeopardizing our in-state refineries?
Through the chair, Representative Wilson, I do not. I don't have that sort of insight into refined fuel markets. I am not as familiar with the situation that befell the refinery in your district. I don't know. I don't have an answer to that question. I'm sorry.
Mr. Chairman.
Representative Wilson.
We need to find out that answer. I mean, that's huge. We had a battle a few years ago. You were instrumental in that as well as I was on trying to make sure that we kept our in-state refinery strong. And if we end up tipping the scale and they can start buying it from outside. In the governor's bill, did they have to where they were taxing gas at Cook Inlet anywhere?
Through the chair, Representative Wilson, the so-called tax caps, the PPT, really the ELF pegged tax caps that are part of the PPT bill were not changed in the governor's bill. The expectation was we're going to get rid of a lot of these credits and we'll allow or accept that the taxes will be effectively zero for the next 5 years, and with the expectation we'll cross that bridge between now and then. The resources version foreshortened that a little bit by creating a working group, the idea of having a bill or a suggestion for how to tax oil and gas in Cook Inlet in before 2002 or in 2022. The version here repeals the tax cap. That is new language. That was not part of earlier versions of the bill. And to be clear, it only repeals the tax cap for oil. The 17-cent tax cap on gas remains in place until 2022, the way the CS is written.
So follow up.
Representative Wilson.
In English, that's zero, right?
The 17 cents is zero?
No, the first gas.
Through the chair, Representative Wilson, I apologize if I say too many words, but I'll try to make it. We are not taxing gas. We are not suggesting taxing gas, and there is no gas tax in the CS.
I'm going to follow up.
Representative Wilson.
Why not? I mean, we're trying to be fair, right? I keep hearing fair, and I'm from the interior. There is nothing fair when it comes to energy. My bush communities can say the same thing, so we're not going to get a bill to make things fair. So is it because, you know, most of it stays in state, and so we don't want to make others pay their fair share? Or is there the same issue as what we just talked about with taxing oil in the Cook Inlet too much to a point to where the buyers that we heard from, Instar and others, that they might go outside to bring gas in because that would be more affordable than producing it here?
Through the chair, Representative Wilson, I think importing gas into Cook Inlet is a little bit bigger deal logistically than importing oil. That would take a little bit of work and lead time. No, from my own read of the hearings back in 2006, the caps were put in place for the same reason a lot of the credits were put in place, because of the fear of a gas shortage in Cook Inlet. To the extent that problem is at least somewhat resolved, maybe it's time to talk about a gas tax in Cook Inlet. When I said we're not looking to tax gas, I want to correct myself. The 17-cent tax in Cook Inlet for most everyone now is zero, but the reason it's zero is because of the small producer credit. As I said in my answer to Representative Guerra's question, the small producer credit's starting to phase out. So over the next couple of years, some of that gas in Cook Inlet's going to actually start paying the 17-cent tax.
And Mr. Chairman.
Representative Wilson.
And I really think why we're going around and around the table like a merry-go-round is we don't get all the information. Okay, so we hear about credits that they can cash for cash. We hear about ones that they can put on their taxes. But the part we don't really hear is how much money we're actually making every year. And it's not all in 1 year. like you said, we got a windfall 1 year. So if we took that 1 year for that windfall, our investment was darn good because we got a lot back on that particular year. But the years we built up to that, it might look like our investment wasn't very good because it takes so many years to get a field ready for, you know, from drilling the hole to be able to develop it to actually getting it down, you know, the pipeline. So since you're the only expert that I have here, in our place, sitting where we are, how am I supposed to take this bill, the governor's bill, I don't care whose bill it is, and help better explain to my constituents that these are investments that we're making that we don't necessarily see in 1 year? And when do we know as legislators when we've tipped the scale too much, and what we'll do is get more money today, but we've just messed ourselves up 5 or 6 years from now because we're starting all over again. And that's really the debate around this table. So is there a better way for us to understand how our investments are going? Because so far it seems pretty darn good.
Commissioner.
Through the chair, Representative Wilson, certainly I think there's no doubt that the change in RCA regulations on price as well as the credits turned Cook Inlet around as far as the gas availability. And I think the question of, you know, where are we at in the process is if we change now, is that going to be a problem? I think the DNR's testimony on the reserves within Cook Inlet is pretty compelling about the amount of gas that is behind pipe or easily developed at this point in time. And that was part of the governor's decision when he decided to, on the Cook Inlet, to pull back on some of those exploration and development credits, was that recognition that we feel like we can take a hiatus from incentivizing oil and gas exploration and development in Cook Inlet. We do have a supply that's sufficient.
So, Mr. Chairman, let's move back up to the North Slope again. I just want to make sure it's on record. If we were not at the oil prices we are today, would we even be discussing changing the tax on the North Slope again? Or would we go ahead and see whether or not, give it a few more years to see if what we have just changed worked? Let's say it was at $70 a barrel instead of $30.
Through the chair, Representative Wilson, I think there we are not making sufficient or significant changes in the North Slope on the credit side. The big issue was the hardening of the floor in the 4 to 5%. Would we be having that discussion at higher oil prices? Absolutely not. Because we wouldn't be at the floor and they wouldn't be going negative. It just simply wouldn't be an issue. As far as Cook Inlet is concerned, I think, yes, I think the discussion is very largely driven by the low oil prices and our ability to pay the credits because, quite frankly, we cannot provide certainty and stability to industry if we've got a credit regime that when it comes time to write the check, we don't have enough money to write it.
Thank you.
All right, for a final question tonight, Representative Kawasaki.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. We've heard a lot about the extensive credits in the Cook Inlet and on the North Slope, but our clan lives in Middle Earth, and I had questions on Middle Earth in particular. In the production, the details stuff that we've got, is the non-North Slope, is Middle Earth included in that area?
Through the chair, Representative Kawasaki, yes, there are simply too few transactions in Middle Earth. There's not enough people doing work that we could not, under confidentiality law, report it. So we just lump them together with Cook Inlet and call it non-North Slope. But it's a very small percentage of what you see there is Middle Earth.
Just follow up. Yeah, can you give me sort of, by way of percentage, what percentage would be considered Middle Earth?
Through the chair, Representative Kawasaki, I'm going to answer your question with an anecdote because I'm a professional tax administrator and sworn to confidentiality. And the anecdote is I was speaking at Senator Giesel's tax credit working group over the fall. Three times I testified to that committee. The third one was on the subject of Middle Earth credits, and I said to the committee roughly what I just said to you in this committee, that I can't talk about it. The numbers are too small and too few. And the gentleman who testified after me was a representative of the Doyon Corporation, and he said, you know, I appreciate the tax director saying that and not being able to talk about confidential data, but I can because it's mostly about us. And I could tell you that lifetime we've received about $60 million. Now, he said that. I didn't say it, so I could repeat it to you. But they are certainly the largest user of exploration services and trying people looking for oil and gas in the interior, and that's the number they reported for the credits they had earned to date.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And then just actually one brief question. There's a very small change in this where exploration credits would be extended for wells that are spudded in by the end of this fiscal year. Can you tell me what the – are there wells being spudded right now? And I guess is there – there looks like to be a fiscal impact anticipated.
Through the Chair, Representative Kawasaki, the section to which you're referring is an amendment to the so-called Frontier Areas Credit, the super credit, the 80% credit that was put in place for those six red circles on the map, the high probability areas. And previous testimony in another committee, it might have been in this committee, I haven't heard all of it, the gentleman from the Aetna Corporation were testifying and saying they are doing work. They have gone through all the hoops to qualify for this particular exploration well credit and 80% credit. They've got their DNR permits. They're ready to go. They are afraid that their first well that might, in fact, supply gas for Greater Glen Allen for a generation might not be done by July 1st. So I believe that particular amendment will make sure that if they have a well that's halfway done, the entirety of that specific well would qualify for that 80% credit.
And it's 80%.
It is an 80% credit. Now, to be clear, if that provision were not there, they would revert to the underlying Middle Earth credits, which are, without any changes made in this bill, the exploration credits have previously been extended. They're at 60%, they're at 40%, but really 30%, because where they are is within 33 miles of an existing well, so that would reduce their level. And they would get the 25% operating loss credit. So roughly speaking, that well would earn a 55% state credit anyway without the change made in that section. So any fiscal impact to the state is the increment between 55% and 80% of whatever the cost after July 1st.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Thank you, Representative Kawasaki. Director Alper, Commissioner Hoffbeck, I want to thank you very much for being here tonight. At this time, I'm setting aside House Bill 247. Committee members, amendments for House Bill 247 must be turned into my office no later than Thursday, tomorrow at 5:30 p.m. And with that, I am going to adjourn this House committee meeting at 8 p.m. But members, don't go anywhere, please. Stay seated. With that, we are adjourned. I have to give the secretary 2 minutes to get geared up so I can gavel back in from this morning's meeting.
She's just going to gavel out.
No, I got an announcement.
Me too.
Okay. All he's doing is he's bringing it back from recess. He can gavel out.
At this time, I'm gaveling back in from the recess of our 8:30 a.m. meeting. And I'm now going to cancel the 7:30 a.m. call for the meeting and adjourn it. Our next House Finance Committee meeting is tomorrow, Thursday, April 7th, 2016, at 8:30 a.m. At that time, we will hear House Bill 259, Relocation Assistance for Federal Project/Program by House Rules by request of the Governor. And under bills previously heard, we are going to continue hearing House Bill 188, Person with Disability Savings Accounts. And with that, at 8 p.m., we are adjourned.